Colossians 1:9-1:14. The third talk in a series on Colossians was presented by Ron Julian on July 18, 1999, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 1999. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. A brief break occurs in the middle of the following recording. It is the result of the original audio tape switching to the second side.
Well, good morning. We're in Colossians again. Last week, we talked about two parts of the opening of the letter. First, Paul expressed his gratitude for their faith, which is a common thing for him to do in his letters. And then he tells them about his prayer for their spiritual health. Today I want to back up a little bit and slow down and take a second look at Paul's prayer. There are three reasons for that. First of all, we didn't finish it last week, so there are still things that we need to talk about. Secondly, at the end of last week, I felt like I kind of went too fast and tried to stuff too much into one time, so I kind of like to slow down and highlight a few things that I didn't last time. And my third reason is the next section that we're going to talk about is very difficult, and I want another week to think about it. So all of those are really good reasons to kind of slow down and look at the prayer. So let me remind you where we are. Paul is writing to a group of Christians in Colossae. This is not a church that Paul himself founded. It seems to have been started through the teaching of Epaphras. And Epaphras is the one who has told Paul about what's going on in Colossae. And what Epaphras has told Paul tells Paul that there are some good things going on and some bad things going on. On the good side, Paul is encouraged to hear that many people there have embraced the faith. He is genuinely grateful that these people have said yes to the gospel, and he sees that as a work of God. At the same time, though, he's been told that some bad heretical teaching is getting hold in Colossae, so bad that it really looks as if there are those among the Colossians who are prepared to walk away from the faith and really embrace something quite different. So Paul first tells them of his gratitude for what God has done among them. I think he's confident that at least some of the people who have come to faith there, who have said yes, who have joined the church and embraced the faith, that at least some of them actually are in fact believers who are growing in the faith, and he's greatly encouraged by what he sees. But he's also worried about what is going on there, and so he tells them what his prayer is to God for their spiritual maturity. He prays for their faith, in essence, to become strong and mature. Now, on the one hand, he does this for all the churches that he writes to. I mean, his desire is, very naturally, for the believers, who after all, in a very real sense, are his responsibility. He has been given the task to explain the gospel to them. He's been given the task to correct them when they go wrong. He's the grand overseer of the Gentile churches, in a sense, looking out for what's going on there and trying to lead them into the truth. So he's always praying for the churches that he writes to, but I think it's especially pointed and poignant for us, this particular prayer, because as we go on in the letter, we see that Paul has real concerns that, in fact, many of the people he's writing to are not going on to maturity, but in fact are prepared to walk away from the faith altogether. So this is a very serious concern on his part. If we get the idea that Paul is saying, hey, it's great, you're all Christians, you're all saved, and now, you know, I'd like to tell you about the icing on the cake that I'm praying for. I'm really praying that you would kind of get to that next level and become a really super Christian. I'm really hoping that happens. that's not the spirit of what he's saying here. The choice is always, I would argue, am I going to actually embrace the faith and have it impact my life, or is it going to be something that I keep at arm's distance and thus is not really something that I personally have embraced, something that I personally have taken a hold of and said, this is mine. In essence, what he's praying for is that God would take the beginning, this interest in the faith that they have expressed, and make it take root, ground it in them so that it is really theirs. They really understand what they have believed, and they have embraced it, they're strong in it, they're persevering in it. This is what he wants. So we're going to finish looking at that prayer today. Let me read it to you again. I'm sort of arbitrarily stopping at verse 14 because we're turning a corner at that spot, although it's very much related. Starting in verse 9, Colossians chapter 1. On account of this, from the day we heard of it, we also have not ceased praying for you and asking that you may be filled with the knowledge of His will in all wisdom and spiritual understanding, to walk in a manner worthy of the Lord, to please Him in all respects, bearing fruit in every good work, and growing in the knowledge of the Lord, being empowered with all power, in accordance with His glorious might, unto all perseverance and patience, with joy giving thanks to the Father, who qualified us for a portion of the inheritance of the saints in light, who rescued us from the jurisdiction of darkness, and removed us to the kingdom of His beloved Son, in whom we have redemption, the forgiveness of sins. Okay, so the first phrase I want to revisit here with you is when he starts to pray for them. He says he's asking that you may be filled with the knowledge of His will in all wisdom and spiritual understanding. This is the foundation of everything that Paul is praying for here. In a word, he wants them to understand. Now, this is a powerful idea, and we need to make sure that we give it its full weight. Because we talk about understanding things in life in a lot of different ways. You know, I'm working on my computer, and the blue screen of death comes up. The problem is, I don't understand. I don't know what has happened. I know the kind of thing that might have happened in there, but what am I going to do next? What file am I going to go find and say, aha, this is corrupted, and replace it, and the whole thing will work again? I don't know. I don't understand. Well, we use the language that way. That kind of understanding has consequences. If I don't understand, then my computer is always going to be a kind of a part blessing, part curse. As soon as anything goes wrong, I'm stuck. What do I do? There's that kind of understanding that we can talk about where I want to become the expert in a subject. You know, I want to know everything there is to know about X. And we could do that with the things of the Bible. I mean, I could take the attitude, there are many people who say, I want to become an expert on the Bible. I want to know what it says. You know, you name a verse, I can tell you where it's from. I can explain to you the context of the argument and so on. Nothing wrong with that. That's a great thing to do. I would encourage you all to become such experts. I'm not knocking it at all. But that's not exactly the kind of understanding that Paul's talking about here. He's talking about that sort of understanding where you move from what is really, in our case, a willful ignorance to that spot where you get it, where you're finally willing to see the way things are. Ah, I understand. I have not understood up to now. In fact, I have not wanted to understand, but now I do. It seems to me that one of the ways that we could describe the tragedy of human life is that we are people who act in willful ignorance. We don't know, and we don't want to know. We hurt ourselves, and we hurt other people, because we're living a lie. We're living in a fantasy world. In one way or another, we have constructed a fantasy world. That fantasy world is the kind of place where I put things together such that everything's your fault and it's not my fault. or that fantasy world is the kind of place where I think I've figured out what it is that I really need in life. I really need money. I really need this kind of sexual relationship. I really need X, Y, and Z. And the problem is, I'm wrong. I'm just wrong. I don't get it. I don't understand God. I don't understand that really that He is my creator and what that means. I don't understand that He is my judge and what that means for me. I don't understand the guilt that I am under, the eternal consequences of the choices that I'm making today. I don't understand where real life is to be found. And so, on the basis of a profound ignorance about the world I live in, I proceed to make my choices about how I'm going to live. How am I going to treat you? What am I going to pursue? What am I going to do? What am I not going to do? Based on what makes sense to me in the fictitious world that I live in. I think that is one way that we could describe the tragedy of human life as we know it. So, one of the most profound things that could happen to a person is to come to the place where he or she moves from ignorance to understanding. Where now I see. In fact, I'm right. I understand something about the most important things. I know what reality is all about. I don't know it all, but I know something profoundly important. So profoundly important that it makes all the difference in my entire life and my eternal destiny. That's how important that knowledge is. If you can imagine a scenario of living in a toxic waste dump and thinking that you're living in a great banquet hall, you can kind of picture in one sense the absurdity and the tragedy of our situation. Everything I reach for, thinking I'm getting a great delicacy, is in fact killing me. And that's something like where we stand as human beings. And we're not just ignorant, but we defend our ignorance. We can go to great lengths to construct elaborate explanations of reality that will defend our view of how things are. So Paul is asking for an amazing miracle here, I think. He is asking that they would have a deep understanding of God. God, the one who is the hardest of all things in reality to understand, because he's the one that we most want to be ignorant of. To know God is to bring my entire world into upheaval. And rather than do that, I would rather construct a reality where he's not there, or he's just one nice little piece in the puzzle over here that I can ignore when I want to, instead of seeing him as the fundamental reality with which I must deal. What's God doing? What kind of a person is he? What kind of a person does he want me to be? What has he promised? What do those promises mean to me? Those are the questions that I've got to come to terms with. I need wisdom. That's why Paul is praying for them, that they would get wisdom and spiritual understanding. And as I understand the concept of wisdom, right now I would describe it something like this. Wisdom is the ability to live as I should because I am in touch with reality. Wisdom is not esoteric knowledge that I talk about in my study with a pipe. Wisdom is the eyes to see the way things are and thus the ability to act in accordance with that knowledge. The person who's wise, in a worldly sense, the concept of wisdom really is related to, you picture that scenario where something happens and everyone's running around with their, like a chickens with their heads cut off, and yet there's this one person who understands what's important. He keeps his head. He knows what needs to be done. He knows what we can safely ignore because that's not important. Because he understands, his perception of things is right, and what he does in the middle of that is right. And everybody looks at him and says, wow, I'm going to go stand next to him because he understands. He gets it. He sees what's going on here. I don't, but he does. Well, on a spiritual level, that's what Paul is praying for us, that we would have wisdom. That you and I could go through life with all of the stuff that's coming at us, the distractions, the temptations, the heartaches, the suffering, the persecutions, the interpersonal problems, all of that stuff around us, that we could look at it and see it in perspective. That we would see the big picture and see what's most important. That's what Paul is praying for them. And thus, he says, the result of that would be that they would walk in a manner worthy of the Lord to please him in all respects. That is, that their understanding would lead to a change in the way they live. That's the kind of wisdom that he's talking about. He wants them to get it, to know what God wants in such a deep personal way that it now has an impact on the way they choose to live their lives. That's what he wants. The way I walk, the way I live, matches up with this reality that I say I believe. The more I truly believe, the more belief becomes mine. I know what the gospel says, I know something about who God is, and that's what I'm holding to. The more that is true, the more I will live like a believer. I mean, there's a very natural relationship between what I do and what I think is true. And that's the relationship that Paul's exploring here. I want you to understand so that your life would come to reflect that. And I think the order of here is important. I think sometimes we make a mistake in our teaching and in the way we deal with each other in thinking what this person most needs is to be told what to do in this situation. I need to tell you, do this. Because if you do that, then the practical outcome will be that things will go right and everything will be okay. But that's not the order in which Paul looks at things. What he wants is for them to understand, for them to be wise, for them to have perspective, so that then their actions will be in keeping with that perspective. You know, it's kind of like that old saying, give me a fish and I eat for today, teach me to fish and I eat for the rest of my life. That idea that it's not just, I don't just need a quick fix, I need to have eyes to see, so that whatever comes my way, I can hold on to what's true. So this is his basic prayer. I want you to know the will of God. I want you to be wise and discerning so that your life would be in keeping with that truth about God. You would walk in a manner that is in keeping with the God that you know. Now, at this point, he goes on to spell out four ramifications of understanding God and walking in this way. He kind of stops and let me slow down here and talk about specific aspects of what it is I want to see happening in you. He's got four participial phrases here that he points to. Bearing fruit, growing, being empowered, and giving thanks. So these are four aspects of this general idea that I want you to understand and thus walk in a manner worthy of the Lord. Now let me get a little more specific, he's saying. And so we have a series of concepts that he explores here. And remember, what's really important for us to remember, I don't say it every sentence here, but this is what Paul is praying for. This is what he wants God to do among them. He is, in a sense, exhorting them to walk in a manner worthy of the Lord. He is exhorting them to do the things that he's talking about here. And in the letter, as we go along, we'll see explicitly that he exhorts them to do that. They face a choice. Am I going to embrace this truth or not? But now Paul is looking on the God side of the equation, out of the knowledge that ultimately spiritual understanding is something that God does. I face the choice, what am I going to do in life? But am I ever going to get it when I'm making those choices? It is a miracle of God, the Spirit of God at work in me to make me understand what life is about. that ultimately that's the thing that's going to bring that transformation about. And so Paul is emphasizing both things. Here he's praying, this is what I want God to do for you. Because he genuinely believes that this is the sort of thing that God does. This is not an empty prayer. This is what God does. God has already worked among them in that so many of them have come to an initial faith. But is this the real deal? Well, that's what I want too. I'm praying that God would make this take hold in your life. So he goes on to talk about these four things then. Bearing fruit, growing, being empowered, and giving thanks. First of all, he says, bearing fruit in every good work. This is what I want God to do among you, that you would bear fruit in every good work. Understanding God and what's important leads to a transformation of my actions. And we talked about this last week. Good work, we don't want to think about that as, you know, as being restricted to volunteering at the hospital or something like that. The idea is that just in every aspect of my life, how am I living with my spouse? How am I treating my friends? How am I responding to temptation? How am I dealing with my finances? What I believe Paul wants to have bear fruit in my actions. He wants it to work its way out into how I'm living. That's the order, though. Understanding leading to action. He says that he wants them to grow in the knowledge of the Lord. Growing in the knowledge of the Lord. That's another thing, another aspect of what he wants to see happen among them. And it's easy for me to understand what he's getting at here, to see how in the process of, okay, I have this initial faith, I have said, yes, I believe this thing, but as the rubber meets the road, as I'm out there in life wrestling with this stuff, there is this progression of as I come to embrace the truth of the gospel and as it makes a difference in the way I'm living, it also has an effect on my understanding. My understanding is growing. I have a deeper understanding of the things that I truly believed before, but now I'm starting to understand the implications of them for my life. I'm understanding the importance of them and that sort of thing. So this understanding that we're talking about here is not a static sort of one-time thing, but it is, in essence, a thing that grows in this process. I understand a piece of the truth. I bear fruit in my life. It has an impact on the decisions I make. Maybe if only that I deeply repent and throw myself on the mercy of God. But in that process, growth in understanding happens as well. And then we also talked about last week, he says, being empowered with all power in accordance with his glorious might unto all perseverance and patience. We are weak people. Not only do we need to understand and walk in a manner that reflects our understanding, but we have to be aware that there are obstacles in our path. There are tough things to deal with out there. There are temptations. There are things that are going to pull me away and say, I'd rather have that. There are sufferings to be borne, things that I may face and say, you know, I don't want this anymore. I want out. There are all kinds of things along the way that put pressure on me to take a different alternative than the one that God is offering in the gospel. And we are weak people. When I talk about this, I hope I don't sound glib about those pressures, because I have faced those pressures in my life. I know what they are like, and I know how weak I am. I know how easy it would be for me to walk away. And I say that as a person who has been a Christian for a long time, and I think someone who has arrived at a certain small amount of maturity in my life as a believer. Nonetheless, I feel like just one strong wind could blow me away. Because I am not by nature a strong person. And I don't think any of us are. So where am I going to find the strength to hold on in the midst of the gale that is blowing around me? And I really think it is a gale. Well, Paul is praying that they would be empowered with the power of God, the glorious might of God. You think of God, if you come to understand, God is the one that cannot be thwarted. God is the one, there is not, we could get together, all of us, and decide to build a big tower. And God just comes along and says, no, gone. That's the strength and the power. That's a teeny little example of the strength and power of the God of the universe. Nothing in this world can resist him. So, that's the glorious strength that Paul is praying would be at work in empowering me, taking a weak person like me and making me strong. That's what he's praying for. That the power of God would be at work in me such that I would be a person who is persevering and patient. In the face of whatever comes my way, I'm still hanging on, I'm still waiting expectantly for God to save me. That's the sort of person that I need to be, and that's what Paul is praying for. Okay. Those are the things that we talked about last week some, but I wanted to sort of back up and slow down a little bit and give an overall picture. We did not get to the next phrase, and I want to start now talking about the new material with, we're in verse 12, with joy giving thanks to the Father, he says. This is the fourth participle. Bearing fruit, growing, being empowered, and giving thanks. This is the fourth aspect of what he wants. He wants the Colossians, and I think if he knew us, he would want it for us as well, that we be people who are thankful to God. He wants us to bear fruit in our lives. That is, he wants what we believe to have such an impact on our hearts that it affects the way we live. He wants us to grow in an understanding of God. He wants us to, by the grace of God, to have the strength to hold on, and he wants us to be grateful. And that's what I want to talk about here. Understanding leads to gratitude toward God. Well, I want to talk about this some, but let me go on here. Paul is about to spell out, I think, what it is we have to be grateful for. We're giving thanks to the Father. And who is the Father? Who is this Father that we're giving thanks to? Well, Paul is about to tell us. This is the Father that we're giving thanks to. And thus, these are the things that we are grateful for. He says, giving thanks to the Father who qualified us for a portion of the inheritance of the saints in light. If I understand the deep problem that I am in as a human being, then I come to understand that I do not qualify for eternal life. I am under the wrath of God. When I come to understand what evil is really all about, I come to understand that when you look at the category of evil people, I'm in that category. It's not just Hitler. It's not just Stalin. It's me. I am a rebel against the truth. Everything that's good and right in the world, I have put at arm's length and said, I will be willing to acknowledge it occasionally when it suits me. That's the sort of person I am. What does that mean for my destiny as a human being? It means I'm wrecking my life now and I'm going to lose it in the end. That's my story. Who is this Father that I'm being grateful to? He is the one who has reached out and qualified me to have an inheritance. The inheritance that I do not qualify for, he has qualified me. He has said, I will do what it takes to take care of the problem that you have. You don't deserve the blessing that I have to give, but I'm going to arrange it so that you do. I'm going to work it out so that you get it in spite of your problem. I have my portion as a believer of the inheritance of the saints. It kind of picture, I think, If you picture that scenario, I have, you know, a parent or a relative who has a vast estate, and they've died, and I'm there at the reading of the will. And there are a lot of people here at the reading of the will. And the question I have, the thing that sort of has me on edge is, do I have my share? Do I have a share in this inheritance that is about to be announced? Is there a portion for me? Or have I been left out? You know, I mean, you've seen all those movies, you know, the mystery movies and all that kind of stuff. They read the will, and here's the person over here who's smiling, and here's the person over here who's grumpy and put out because, you know, Uncle Chester left them out of the will. I don't have a share in this. Here's all these guys. He got some, he got some, he got some, and I got nothing. What did God do for his people? He qualified us so that we get a share. I have myself, personally, a share in the inheritance of the saints. It's not just something that comes to this group out there. There's a part that comes to me. He calls it the inheritance of the saints in light. And there are different ways to put that phrase together. I think what he means, in essence, is he's saying the saints have an inheritance that we could characterize as being an inheritance in light. Light is what they're going to receive, and I have my portion. I think that's what he means. And when we think about the way the Bible, and very naturally, tends to use the symbolism of darkness and light, I think we can see the kind of thing they're getting at. Nighttime is the time it's dark. I can't see. I'm stumbling around. I can't see what's going on. Nighttime is the dangerous time when evil tends to reign because there's no light shining on it and it can do what it wants. On the other hand, light, the daytime, is that time when everything is in the light. Nothing can hide. Everything is seen for what it is. And also, we have that imagery of light. There is something in our nature that we find light attractive. It has that glory. It is bright. It is pure. The darkness has that idea of obscurity and dirtiness. And the light is that pure thing. Well, our inheritance is to get a portion of the kingdom of the light. I have been in the darkness of evil and ignorance, but I have an inheritance that is going to bring me into the light. That's what I understand him to be saying. Where goodness reigns, where purity reigns, where everything is seen, there are no shadows, all is made known. I think that's the kind of thing that he's getting at. So God is the one who qualified us for a portion of the inheritance of the saints in light. And then he goes on. He is the one who rescued us from the jurisdiction of darkness and removed us to the kingdom of his beloved Son. I have been under the jurisdiction of darkness. I have been under the wrath of God. There is a blessing that God has for his people, but I have not been one of his people. I have been apart from him. I have been under his curse. And so it's as if I have been cut adrift in this world. I belong to this world and the God of this world. Whatever Satan is doing in this world, I have been subject to because I have been under God's wrath. And the destiny of this world has been my destiny. This world is a place that cannot satisfy me now and will fail me in the end. And that's the jurisdiction I have been under. My life today has been determined by the jurisdiction of darkness, and my destiny has been under the jurisdiction of darkness. It's not good now, and it's going to get worse. That's what it means when you're under the jurisdiction of darkness. But I have been rescued. God is the one who reached out to rescue me. Think of an adventure movie. You know, the hero, at great risk to himself, goes behind enemy lines, hacking his way there, to grab me, to take me out of the domain, the rule, the imprisonment of the bad guys, and bring me over to the side of the good guys. That's what God did. That's what the cross of Christ is all about. I mean, in that sense, I mean, I'm not trying to trivialize anything here, but, you know, Jesus is like Rambo. I mean, Jesus on the cross is Rambo coming in and blasting the bad guys and saying, I'm here for you. That's what it is. I mean, that's better, because what can Rambo do? I mean, he can give me a few more years living here, and I'm still going to die, and I'm still going to face the judgment of God. But this is a rescue operation that really works, because it rescues me from the deepest problem I have. And then who is this God? Well, no, excuse me. In describing this God, he's talked about who he is, but he mentioned here that he has removed us to the kingdom of his beloved Son. And now he takes a little turn, and in fact, from here on, we're definitely going to turn in this direction, because now the focus is shifting from who is the Father and what has he done, to who is the Son and what has he done and who is he. So, I have been rescued by the Father into the kingdom of his beloved Son. And who's that? He is the one in whom we have redemption, the forgiveness of sins. Jesus is the means by which the Father has reached out to rescue me. I have been redeemed. I have been forgiven. My deep problem has been that I have been under the wrath of God, but I am there no longer. My destiny is no longer in the power of Satan. Today, now, I am a citizen of the kingdom of God, a kingdom that has not appeared yet in its fullness, but nonetheless, I am under the rule of Christ. My destiny is in his hands. My life in this world is in his hands. When Paul says all things work together for good for those who love God, that's another way of saying that I have been rescued from the kingdom of darkness and brought into the kingdom of his Son. I have been forgiven and thus am under the blessing of God. That's where I am. That's why Paul thinks we ought to be grateful. Now let me talk a little bit about gratitude and then I'm going to be quiet. But I think gratitude is a huge issue. I think it is a huge issue in the Bible, and I think it is a huge issue to us as people. It has been a huge issue in my life. Even as a mature Christian, I hope a mature Christian, I have had to face the fact at times in my life that I am not grateful to God for the life that he has given me. And what I mean is, I mean, that sounds terrible. It makes it sound like I hate being married to Robbie or something like that. I don't mean that. But I think all of you know what I mean. All of you have had those things in your life that you don't want there. Sufferings that you would rather go without. Deprivations that you would like to fill. And yet it's not happening. And those things loom large. And when they loom large, I feel distinctly ungrateful for my life. Life is tough sometimes. How can I be grateful when I am not happy with the life that I am living? That's a huge question. It seems to me that there are various approaches that human beings take to this question about being grateful to God. First of all, our approach can just be, I'm not. I am rightly facing into the fact that there are difficulties in my life, and my attitude is, I am resentful, I am bitter, I hate God. I recognize that there is a God, or maybe I don't. Maybe I deny that he's there because if he were there, he would do something about this. Or if I believe that he's there, I'm ticked off at him because of the life that he's given me. So I'm realistic about the sufferings in this life up to a point, and my attitude is, I'm mad as hell and I wish I didn't have to take it anymore. But I do. Okay. It seems to me there is another approach, and this is a very dangerous one, and I see it all around me in the Christian community, and it's part of it is so dangerous is because it's superficially attractive, but in fact, it has the potential to be deadly. And essentially what I'm talking about is gratitude through denial. I look at my life and I think, I'm okay. I'm a good person. I don't have problems. I have everything I want. I got money. I got position in the community. Everybody at the church thinks I'm a great guy. I'm happy. I'm happy with all this. I'm grateful to God for making everything so great. I can't help thinking of the Pharisee in Jesus' prayer parable, who prays to God and says, God, I thank you that I am not like other men. He's grateful. I mean, that's gratitude to God, right? That's what Paul's talking about, being grateful to God. But what's he grateful for? He's grateful for something that isn't true. He thinks he's better than other people, and he's grateful to God for that being the case. That's what I mean by denial. That sort of sense where, in fact, I am not looking at myself. I don't understand how deep my own problem is. I don't understand the superficiality of whatever position in the community I have and wealth I have and all of that kind of stuff. I don't understand how insignificant that stuff all is. I don't understand the eternal issues that are at stake. Somehow I just see God as the one who's come along and made me great and my life great, and I'm grateful. All of us can fall into that kind of trap at times, but it can be a deadly sort of trap because it is a gratitude that is rooted in not understanding, is not rooted in wisdom and knowing the will of God, which is what Paul is praying for at the beginning, but it's rooted in a willful ignorance of myself and the value of the things around me. That kind of gratitude, in the end, doesn't really mean much, I would say. There's another kind of gratitude that I think is sort of problematic. I'm not sure. You could call this a kind of gratitude through denial as well. I don't think this is what the Bible is talking about either. For this person, they do understand that things are hard. They know that they have problems. They understand that things are tough, that they are suffering, that there are things about themselves that are not right. I mean, they get that much of it. But they think that the Christian message is, and the Christian community around them is giving the message, that it is unfaithful, it is unspiritual to suffer when things are bad. It is unspiritual to be in pain when things are painful. The spiritual person is a grateful person, and so you need to go around smiling and saying, it doesn't matter to me. I know I'm suffering, but it doesn't matter to me. I'm grateful. And so it's this kind of gratitude which is trying to stuff away the reality of life and maybe not succeeding so well, but doing it because I think that's what I'm supposed to do. I don't think that's the kind of gratitude that the Bible is talking about either. The kind of gratitude that Paul is talking about, we can see. He tells us what the grounds are for that gratitude. What are those grounds? What is it that I as a believer have to be grateful for? I once was lost and now am found. Was blind and now I see. I mean, every time we sing that song, Amazing Grace, we're talking about the very kinds of grounds that Paul is talking about here for gratitude. What's my biggest problem as a human being? I'm lost. I'm under the King of Darkness. I am going to suffer in this life a pointless suffering that will yield no fruit and will end in my eternal destruction. That's my problem. What is it that God has done for his people? He's reached out and he's rescued me from that. He sent Jesus to die on the cross to bring me out from under the jurisdiction of darkness. So, am I a sinner? Yes. Am I going to pay for it? No. Am I a sinner? Yes. Am I going to inherit? Am I going to have a portion in the eternal, forever and ever blessing that God has for his people? The eternal life, which is going to be everything that life ought to be? Do I have a portion in that? Yes, I do. Is it true that it is no profit to gain the whole world and lose your soul? Yes, it's true. I could gain everything that this world has to offer me, and yet if I do not enter into the kingdom of God and lose my soul in the process, then I got nothing. I got nothing. Is the reverse of that true? Could I lose everything in this world? And if I have retained my soul and it enters into God's kingdom and the eternal blessing that He has there, am I a winner? Yes, I am. I have won everything. I have lost nothing. That's just the way it is. If the gospel is true, then that's the way it is. Now, if I'm one of those people who has a portion in the inheritance to come, then I have everything. That's what Paul thinks. I mean, maybe Paul's an idiot. Maybe he doesn't know what he's talking about. But we're here together on the assumption that Paul is a messenger for God. He claims to be one. He claims that Jesus himself selected him and taught him. And this is what he wants for us based on what he understands life to be all about. He wants the Colossians and he wants us to get it, to understand that all of this is true, and thus I am free to suffer when things are bad. I am free to be in pain when things are painful. But I am also free, in spite of those things, to be grateful, because I know this is a painful journey towards the very thing that I want most in the world, which God is going to assure that I get. That's what Paul wants them to understand. That's what Paul wants God to do for them, that they would so understand the magnitude of what he has done that they would be grateful, that they would look at that and have the appropriate emotional response. Isn't that the appropriate emotional response if all of that stuff is true? If all of that stuff is true, then I am insane. I am so out of touch with reality that I am literally insane if I am not grateful for what God is doing. Now, all of us suffer from that form of insanity to one degree or another because we are so short-sighted, because we find it so easy to concentrate on the stuff that's right in front of my face and to forget about the big picture, to forget about why God is taking me through this life and where He is taking me in the process. So when I say you're insane, I don't mean, you know, if there's anybody in here who happens to have ever been ungrateful, what are you doing amongst us? I don't mean that at all. Every one of us has been there. I have been there. Not just have been there, but, I mean, I am tempted to feel that way today. When I am telling you the grounds that Paul says we ought to be grateful, I am reminding myself as much as I am reminding you, because there's a lot of tough stuff in my life right now. And I'm not grateful for it immediately. I mean, I don't look at that and the first thing I think is, this is going to be good for me in the end. My first thought is, oh man, what in the world is going on? I don't want this. I do not want this. That's my first reaction. Of course it's my first reaction. I'm an idiot. So I lose sight. But the fact is that what I want for myself and what I want for you is what Paul wants for us, that we would not lose sight of these things, that we would come to understand that they're true so that our perspective on things would give us joy and gratitude. Not joy for the suffering, but joy in spite of the suffering because I know what this is ultimately leading to. The progression is understanding leads to gratitude. The more I understand in the sense that I see the truth and I've embraced it and I believe it, yeah, this is what it's about, the more I am going to be grateful. This is the challenge in essence. This process that Paul is describing here is the completion. This is the fruition of my faith over time in my life. What Paul wants is instead of going down the road that he sees the Colossians going down, some of them at any rate, where they have turned away from what's true and are embracing instead an attractive lie about things, he wants them to drink deeply of the truth of the gospel in such a way that it makes a difference. It makes a difference in how they act, and it makes a difference in how they feel about their life in the middle of it. That's what he wants. It's a profound thing that he's praying for. It is a profound revolution in my understanding and the way I live that he's praying for. I can't emphasize enough, this is not a little deal. This is everything. If you think about and are honest about how prone you are as a human being to miss the point in your life, you understand how profound a truth, a profound a thing that Paul is praying for here. I want you to be a person who does not miss the truth. I want you to be a person who sees it and understands it and welcomes it and lives in the light of it and is grateful because you know that that's the way things are. That's what he wants for them. Well, I think it's a big deal. When I read this kind of stuff, my first reaction is, yeah, that's what I want for me too. And then my second reaction is, I occasionally, at least, I stop to remember you all and think, well, that's what I want for you too. The fact is, this is what we ought to want. What else is there to want? I mean, let's just be blunt about it. What else is there in this life that is worth lusting after? This is worth lusting after, I think. To desire to be the kind of person who understands God and thus finds the ability, the growing ability to live life in the light of that understanding. To be a person who can forgive other people because I understand the forgiveness of God. To be the sort of person who can hold lightly to the stuff in this world because I understand where the valuable stuff is. To be a person who can be grateful when things are difficult, not because I'm grateful for pain, but because I know who God is and what he's up to. There isn't anything else worth wanting. I mean, ultimately. I mean, if you got that, then the rest of the package falls into place. If you don't have that, then you really are in the darkness. Well, pound on the pulpit. Let's take a few minutes now for any questions or comments you may have. As I've said, we turned the corner here to talk about who Christ is and what he did, and that's what we're going to go on to talk about next time. I have sort of arbitrarily stopped here because we're kind of turning a theological corner at this spot and we'll be talking about different stuff.
I was wondering, you seem to be taking like these, what, like 5-6 verses, or whatever they are, mm-hmm. and making a lot of talk about it and mm-hmm. making it sound like it's like the essential part of Christianity, which I don't doubt that it is. Okay. But how do you know that these 5 verses out of the whole entire Bible deserve that much attention?
Well, let's just take the issue of what is on Paul's mind in the letter to the Colossians, for example. What we're going to find as we go through the book is that these same issues are going to be the issue over and over and over again. Okay, so what I'm saying is what he's praying for here for them is what he's going to turn around and exhort them to in the letter as we go on, that basically the same issues keep coming up. So I'm not saying out of all of the Bible, I'm saying that these are the most important verses and the rest is not so important. What I'm saying is, and what's true in Colossians is true of all Paul's letters, as I go through and say, here's what he's talking about, here's what he's talking about, here's what he's talking about, and I look at Jesus and say, here's what he's talking about, here's what he's talking about, I step back and I have these piles of topics, and the stuff he's talking about here, they're these, like these huge piles from every place I look in the Bible, which is what tells me I think this is central. Because this is what they keep talking about. And then there's a certain logic to it as well. If you keep finding Paul praying, saying, this is what I want for you, I think it's legitimate to ask the question, why does he keep wanting that stuff? Why doesn't, there are lots of other stuff, things that he could want for them. Why is that always what he wants? And I think a good preliminary answer is because he thinks this is the most important stuff. And when I look at the rest of the Bible and ask myself, does that hold up? Sure enough, that seems to be what the Bible thinks is the most important stuff. So, yeah, yeah. The repetition and seeing the logic in passage after passage, you know, what are they getting at there? Yeah. Anything else?
Well, it was almost gone. in the place where it says we're strengthened in all power, I think. I can't remember exactly. But
right.
Obviously, from the questions I've been asking recently, I've been looking a lot at other churches and how they think.
Right.
And one of the things that they talk about a lot is power. And I don't think they'd go in the direction that you're going in today.
Right.
What made you choose that direction? Was it isolated just to these passages? Or is power something that you look at primarily in this way?
Well, in a way, my answer would be similar to what I said to Amy. Both of those things are true. In the passage itself, in the structure of the language, what he says is that his praying that they would be empowered with all power unto strength and, unto perseverance and patience. That is, literally, the kind of thing he's saying is, I want God to empower you so that you will persevere and be patient. So his idea here, the focus, there may be other kinds of power that he would be interested in, but what he's praying for here is that power which gives me the strength to endure, to persevere. That's the specific topic that he's talking about. Now I bring to it, let's take the topic of perseverance. How big a topic is that in Paul's writings and in Jesus' teaching and so on? It's a huge topic. It's there over and over and over again. And I think I've come to see something of what the place of perseverance and the importance of perseverance is in the Christian life. Now let's talk about the concept of power. Let's look at the way Paul talks about the power of the Spirit and so on. And again, I would argue, when we look at passages that talk about power, although we do see examples of the Spirit of God having the power to, you know, to oversee the creation of the world and to, to do something like have somebody speak in tongues and that sort of thing, Paul, when he talks about the power that he wants to see operating in believers, it is always this kind of power, the power of God that is at work for my spiritual strength. And even in the one passage where he really does talk about the power of the Spirit at work in things like speaking in tongues and healing and that kind of stuff, his emphasis there is to downplay those things, to say, okay, they have a place, but that's not what the heart of it is about. The heart of it is that thing the Spirit is doing in every believer. Not everyone is an apostle. Not everyone is a healer. Not everyone speaks in tongues, he says. But every believer has the Spirit at work in them. And then how does Paul picture the Spirit working? Well, when we go and see, here's one of the examples of how he sees the Spirit working. The Spirit is giving me the strength to persevere. So it's a complicated picture. It's partly in this passage, and it's partly putting together the picture from a number of places. Here, I hope at least, someone coming from a charismatic perspective, and I probably would disagree about a lot of those things out there in the Bible, I would hope that in this passage, because of the explicit thing that Paul says, I want you to be empowered with the power of God so that you will persevere and be patient, in essence, is what he's saying. I would hope that they would recognize that that's the issue here. I think we could agree on that, that we would look together and say, we may disagree on the extent of what the power of the Spirit is doing among Christians now, but surely we can agree that here, this is what Paul has on his mind. And I would bet with a lot of people that we would agree at that point.
It seems to me that this passage is prima facie a problem for charismatic theology, because given the logic that you've laid out, he's setting out to say, when all is said and done, let's cut to the chase, what do I really want for you? Charismatic theology, over and over and over again, is saying, what I want for you is that you want more than that you have.
Right.
What I want for you is that you want everything that God wants to give you, which are all these bells and whistles of God's power at work in your life.
Right.
And that's, on the surface, not what he's saying here.
Right.
And so, it in the very least, it calls into question the emphasis.
Right. That's a good point, Jack, because and I think I may have said this before, but there is a difference. I have known in my life two kinds of what we'll broadly call charismatics. I mean, charismatic actually kind of has a specific theological focus. There's this group of people who have a different view of what the Spirit is doing right now than I do. Some of those charismatics that I have known, it seems to me, would eagerly embrace the picture that Paul is painting here. That is, they don't see those gifts of the Spirit as being central to what God is doing. They understand the centrality of spiritual maturity and the kinds of things we're talking about here. We just have a difference of perspective on, in fact, what is the extent of what God is doing in this world. I have known people that I think are in that spot. They believe that God is doing things in their life that I admit I have some questions about whether everything that's happening there is what they think it is. But I'm happy to disagree on those things. I mean, we can disagree on that, and it is of little consequence, I think. But there is another aspect to the charismatic world, which is the kind of thing that Jack is talking about, where there is a significant part of it that its emphasis is on you can be happy now. You can have power, and power means the power to overcome all obstacles, the power to get what you want, the power to have wealth, the power to have successful marriage, the power to have a dynamic sex life. I mean, literally, there's teaching that is all about that. Go and turn on the Trinity Broadcasting Network just about any time, day or night, and listen to the teacher on there. I can guarantee you that you're going to find somebody saying, your problem out there is that you're not getting the doubt out. You need to believe that God is going to give you everything you want. The reason you don't have it is because you haven't believed that God's going to give it to you. Do they talk about persevering in faith? Never. I can't say never. Never in my experience has anybody ever talked about that. How big is their Bible? It's about 3 pages. Of verses that they have gone through and pulled out of the Bible that they think they can use to defend the idea that I can have it all now. There are whole ministries built on the message over and over and over again. That's all that is they say. I told you one time about one of those teachers. I heard him say, one day you're going to get to heaven and you're going to go to God and you're going to say, I'm here for the blessing that you promised. And God is going to say to you, you missed it. If I'd have had a gun, I would have shot my television when I heard it. I'm not kidding. I was so angry. This is not just a disagreement about whether the modern phenomenon of speaking in tongues is from God or not. This is a fundamental perversion of what the gospel is all about. So there's a real difference, I think, and I think it's important for us to recognize that. What Jack is talking about, I think, is right, that when you're in that spot where you have put the focus on those sorts of things, then ultimately this passage and a whole series of passages in Paul, his perspective about what is important, where is the heart of this stuff, I think we have to say they have put the heart of it over here, and Paul puts the heart of it over here. And that's a very serious thing. But it is important to make that distinction, because not every disagreement about charismatic things is a fundamental disagreement about the faith, but I think some of them are. And so it's an important distinction to... I think I'm going to stop here. We've already gone over an hour, so we'll let the folks with the kids out. And next week, I'm going to attempt to talk about a very difficult passage, so you're going to come and be patient with me.